This is A Question of Balance on 2SER 107.3 FM. Good evening, I'm Ruby Vincent. This is our last interview with Dr. Barry Manilow for 2017, and I think he's a pretty happy chappy, what with the success by Elon Musk in relation to the biggest battery ever.
I am indeed feeling happy that I think it was late last week that the world's biggest battery in South Australia was batched into the South Australian electricity grid to help to stabilise it during an unforeseen event where some other generators went offline, and I think it performed extremely well. It didn't stop several of the usual suspects trying to denigrate the battery and saying that the problem that they had in the first instance was due to an over-reliance on renewable energy, but the fact is the battery actually performed its stabilization function extraordinarily well, and it'll be very interesting to see how it goes with further events of that type during the summer.
I think there's probably a pretty chuffed premier in South Australia who was being called rather unkind things by the federal government.
Yes, indeed. I think old Jay Weatherill is probably very happy that everything seems to be working as designed, not to mention Tesla, who built and commissioned the battery. So yes, I think that there's smiles all around there.
That's interesting, isn't it? Because Musk's success means that South Australia has to fork out $50 million for the battery, but I think the Premier thinks they're going to save more than that every year in terms of cost of electricity.
Yeah, I think it was actually substantially more than $50 million. The actual figure, as far as I'm aware, has not been published, but there are proposed savings to consumers, although I'm not sure if that's going to be the key benefit, because savings are generally very small. It's like $40 per household or something. That I think the main saving would be the avoiding having to build another gas peaking power station or something like that to stabilize the grid. Instead, they've got a battery bank that they can switch in and out virtually instantly.
This one has really received a bit of attention, less than I would have expected, actually, given all the negative publicity that went on when all the naysayers said, oh, it won't work, it's just a stunt.
Look, I think it's the negative comments that were made about the battery. Who was it? I can't recall who actually said it, but it was some CEO of some, you know, fairly large organization said that the entire capacity of the battery was only, you know, good to cover the energy needs of a relatively small number of households. In saying that, he completely missed the point, because 70% of the capacity of that 100 megawatt battery in South Australia is to fulfill what are known as ancillary services for the grid, which is to stabilize the grid when it's in danger of losing its 50 hertz frequency. It's not to power houses at all. Only 30% of the battery capacity is to directly power houses. So by making a statement like that, it's clear that, you know, he's probably reflecting the fact that a lot of naysayers actually have no idea what they're talking about. And the function that it did fulfill, which was to stabilize the grid, it actually performed extremely well.
I think that message has not been conveyed clearly to the general public, which is a great shame.
Yeah, look, it is a great shame, but it's also to some degree understandable, because the whole concept of stabilizing the grid and ancillary services and stuff it's pretty complicated, and it's not easy to explain that kind of thing easily to the general public, other than saying the battery's primary purpose is not to provide houses with electricity, it is to make sure that the electricity supply can function as intended.
Look, I think the whole notion of the grid is perplexing and horribly confusing to most of us ordinary consumers. I certainly have very little idea of it, except it is complex and it seems to have a lot of opportunities where unscrupulous dare I say, governments or power groups can benefit their interests as opposed to the overall Australian consumer.
Yeah, absolutely. I think especially in Australia, there is an enormous amount of vested interest in, you know, due to pressure from the fossil fuel lobby and what have you, and that immediately taints the whole discussion because it just kicks rationality out the window, really.
It's a hat-trick and a win by 19 runs. This game has gone down to the wire. Only one try in it. The ball's in the back of the net in extra time. They've won!
If you have a passion for sport, learn how to put that passion into winning action and gain a degree into the growing world of sports media and sports journalism. To give that winning career a start, join the team that gets results in sport at UTS next semester. Apply to UTS School of Communication, the number one young uni. UTS School of Communication, sponsors of 2SER.
Now, I was more interested in talking about the whole notion of electric cars.
Yeah, the electric car or more generally electric vehicle story at the moment is very, very interesting, I think, to say the least. There have been all sorts of weird and wonderful wild projections about how the global car fleet is going to transition towards electric vehicles away from petrol and diesel vehicles by such and such a year and such a percent. And it's difficult to know exactly who's right and who's wrong in those predictions, but certainly I would say that the electric vehicle revolution has begun.
I was staggered. I don't know how real they are, but to see these great trucks that supposedly were all electric powered, I think it was somewhere in America. Was that real or was that something out of an action movie?
It's real in as much that none other than Elon Musk, who we were speaking of before from Tesla Motors, has launched the Tesla truck, which is called the Semi, and it's a full-sized heavy haulage truck, quite a radical aesthetic. The driver sits in the middle of the cabin with the steering wheel in the middle, and it's got all sorts of amazing claims that it's got a range of around 800 kilometers on a charge and can sit on 100 kilometers an hour up a pretty decent hill. And when the truck is empty, it can accelerate from 0 to 100 kilometers an hour in under 5 seconds, which I'm sure will be very impressive to a lot of truckies that usually have to sit there for the better part of half a minute until that speed is reached.
And Dr. Manor, there are actual real trucks that are demonstrating this. It's not just something on a computer screen.
I would say that Tesla has built a prototype which was used in their launch. So in as much as the real truck as it's going to look does exist, I'm not sure if it's sort of highway ready as yet, but it certainly is an embodiment of the actual design. And it has been seen driving around, I understand. So yes, it's real, but it hasn't gone into production yet.
Seen driving around in which country?
I think in America, Tesla have a pretty substantial sort of proving ground there, and I have heard reports that the truck has been seen driving around there. So usually what they do is they build, you know, one or two of something at a huge expense as a proof of concept, and then they find a way to manufacture it at a fraction of that original cost.
Well, Munzer's battery success must give him huge reputation in success at these mega efforts.
I certainly imagine that Tesla's reputation would be enhanced by the success so far of the South Australian big battery, for example, although, you know, it's only been a few days since that was demonstrated. But it's also fair to say that Elon Musk has a history of promising huge things and then not quite delivering them on the time frame as initially envisaged. But as long as he can survive financially, and there are claims that he won't, but they have been saying that for quite a long time now, and he survives, then I think there will be a lot of the Tesla Model 3 owners, which apparently have 400,000 pre-orders before the car even went into production. So it's pretty amazing to have a product with that level of consumer confidence.
What country is he from?
He's originally from South Africa. He's in America now, and he's basically a fearless visionary with a fairly large budget, but not infinite. I mean, I've heard that Tesla is burning through an incredible amount of cash every day, and, you know, they really need to start getting some of those sales happening in order to keep going.
Well, I would be happy about the very small but very successful one in South Australia. I mean, that was, what, $60, $50 million?
Yeah, yeah. I think, obviously, that's going to be great for their reputation, and also the Tesla Model S and the Model X, which are vehicles that are out there on the road right now, are, by any standards, fantastic vehicles. I mean, they are absolute high-performance vehicles that take all the petrol-powered supercars for a ride, run for their money, should I say, but they are luxury cars and they cost over $150,000 in Australia, so not within everybody's reach.
So he's not interested in the ordinary car on the road?
Well, he is now, because the Model 3 is meant to address that niche, that the Model 3 is meant to be come in at around $30,000, which is comparable to more sort of family-oriented cars. But they are experiencing production problems. He, believe it or not, Tesla Motors is intending to produce 2,000 of those per week from their factory, which is an astonishing output. And they currently are ironing out some production problems in order to start that process.
And would that be enough to keep him going happily?
Yeah, I believe so. I think that if those 400,000 vehicles that they've got pre-orders and indeed cash deposits for, I think once they start delivering those on some sort of revised schedule that people are happy with, to the extent that they won't go cancelling their orders, I think Tesla will survive the production setback.
Now, here in Australia, what is sort of the overall mood in relation to what Munce has been doing?
Well, I think a lot of people are very impressed by him, and he's got a huge fan base, obviously, because he's just one of those global, absolutely fearless entrepreneurs that has popped up in the last couple of decades. He's in the same league as Richard Branson with Virgin Airlines, and also people like Steve Jobs with Apple, you know, just people who've had a vision and worked absolutely relentlessly in pursuit of that vision and then actually made it happen. So there is that kind of belief that Elon Musk is in that category of the elite entrepreneurs that really have a huge impact globally with their particular product and philosophy. I might add that whether Elon Musk lives or dies financially, he has single-handedly revolutionized the automotive industry in both cars and now trucks as well, because just by announcing and indeed building these amazing vehicles that he has done to date, like the Model S and the Model X cars, just about every other major automotive manufacturer in the world, Mercedes, BMW, Renault, Nissan, Toyota, all of them have announced the imminent release of electric vehicles. I think without Tesla, that may not have happened as quickly as it has and as uniformly as it has. So in some respects, he has fulfilled a major function already, even if he doesn't produce another car or truck.
Now, is that aspect of his contribution recognized in the media?
Look, I think Elon Musk's role has been acknowledged to a large extent, but there is constant rumor in the press that he's on the verge of bankruptcy and that sort of thing. So, as I mentioned before, that's almost immaterial because he has basically kickstarted the electric vehicle industry globally, and they've all announced that they're going to follow suit and start making electric vehicles instead of petrol vehicles. So I do think that Musk has certainly been recognized, but there's also a lot of detractors as well.
Now, when he finished it, or even before he finished the biggest battery ever, there were reports that other companies were already set to build bigger ones. I think there was a Queensland-based one that wanted to build one that was three times bigger in South Australia. What's going on with those plans?
You're right about that, Ruby. There is indeed a Queensland-based company called the Lion Group, L-Y-I-O-N, which is indeed planning to build a bigger battery than the 100 megawatt Tesla installation in South Australia. You know, it's basically just to allow all the renewable generation capacity that is already installed and continuing to be installed in South Australia to be stabilized, because, as you know, it's intermittent. The solar farms will only produce energy while the sun's shining and wind while the wind's blowing. So it needs storage in order to provide 24-hour capacity to inject energy into the grid. So that is why there is so much interest in building large storage capacity in that state at the moment.
So that, in fact, gives all sorts of encouragement to furthering renewable energy production in South Australia.
Yes, it does. I mean, I think there is a very firm belief in South Australian government and even to a great extent in the South Australian people that they're onto a good thing. They're watching the rest of Australia struggle with a lack of federal policy and this NEG, the National Energy Guarantee, which doesn't really encourage renewable energy development at all. So the state governments are basically thinking, well, you know, bugger that federal namby-pamby stuff. We're just going to go it alone and draw up our own policies for renewable energy. And so the very engaged ones, obviously, I'd say South Australia is the leader, but Victoria and New South Wales are pretty engaged as well. And even Queensland. I mean, Queensland's got the highest installed solar generation capacity of any state to date, even though their government, well, a few weeks ago was pretty pro-coal, but now seems to have turned around having been re-elected. So it's fair to say the policy is in a bit of a mess and differs from state to state and certainly differs federally.
Hi, I'm Lenore Taylor, the editor of Guardian Australia.
And I'm Rebecca Huntley, researcher and writer.
We've made a new show called Common Ground.
It's where completely different Australians have genuine discussions about the issues politicians fight about.
I don't think politicians are representing Australians anymore. They all seem to have an agenda and there is absolutely no faith in them, I know that.
Common Ground, 7:30pm Mondays or podcast anytime. 2SER 107.3, stories, ideas, music.
Battery storage does help to overcome this problem of what are you going to do when the sun goes down?
The way that we get around it before there is a large amount of storage to store and then regenerate that energy later in the day or when those renewable resources are not available, that's known as firming the network, which injects energy into the network when those resources are not available. That is at the moment done with fossil fuels. So it's either done through the interconnectors from New South Wales and Victoria with coal-fired electricity, or South Australia has a few of its own gas, what are known as peaking power plants, which they can fire up, switch on and switch off fairly quickly. But as more storage is built, that function will shift away from fossil fuel generators and more towards those storages of energy, whichever form they might take. At the moment, they're building batteries, but there's also a number of other pretty clever ways of storing energy and regenerating it at a different time.
When the media talks about energy production, coal and all the rest of it, it always seems to be there are jobs that are going to be lost if we close down coal mines. But there never seems to be comment that there will be more jobs if we expand our wind farms or our solar. Is there a similar exchange of numbers of jobs going from non-renewable to renewable sources?
It's a very unfortunate fact that all we hear about is loss of jobs in the coal industry. We don't hear about the gain of jobs in the renewables industry. And there is massive creation of jobs in the renewables industry. If there were some investment certainty that renewable development can go ahead, and that's what's sorely lacking at a federal government level, there's just no incentive beyond our renewable energy target, which we're now on a trajectory to meet. The concern is that after the early 2020s, there will be no further incentive to develop renewable energy. But if that were to change, or even if as state-based legislation provides the initiative to do that, then of course there's going to be creation of hundreds and hundreds, if not thousands, of jobs in the renewable energy sector. And so the whole notion that there's loss of jobs in the coal industry and no growth of jobs in renewable is complete nonsense.
But in the meantime, with this increase in storage, there must be more people being already employed in renewable areas. Surely we are already skilling up members of the communities and employment in renewable. We're not going to have to wait until the government does something in 2020.
That is true. There are significant challenges in development of renewable energy. One fairly big one is that our energy or electricity grid as it currently stands was never designed for a two-way transfer of energy. It was designed to take energy from big centralized coal-burning power stations and take it all around the countryside to all the cities and areas where the electricity is consumed. It was not designed to have a large number of smallish renewable energy or any sort of generators connected into it at various points along the transmission lines to take in energy and distribute that throughout the grid. So there's quite a challenge if you want to develop a solar farm, you know, to find a point where you can actually get some land that's close to the grid somewhere, where the grid actually has the capacity to accept the energy from that solar farm. That in itself is an impediment to renewable energy development. It just makes it very complicated and quite costly to find out if there is capacity to take your energy or not. But those sorts of things aside, we're on a complete roll in Australia at the moment. There's an enormous amount of activity in the renewable energy space, and it's actually quite an exciting time.
Barry, when you talk about these problems with this archaic grid, we're sort of saying, oh, we've got this old-fashioned way, we're not going to change.
To some extent, we're stuck with the actual transmission grid simply because it costs a huge amount of money to put up that infrastructure, those, you know, what people call Iron Men, those big towers with all the struts and the beams that support those high voltage cables high above the ground. Those things run all the way, you know, from northern Queensland all the way down to Victoria and beyond to South Australia, and that's the actual grid itself. And that's carrying very high voltage electricity from the generators. And then there's the distribution system, which is a sort of a lower voltage system, which is the poles and wires in our street. And it's often when you're building a renewable energy facility somewhere out in the middle of Whoop Whoop, you have to deal with the distribution network, which is a much lower capacity part of the overall system, in order to get your electricity that you produce into the grid. And in many cases, solar farm developers have to build their own connection to the grid. And I've just been involved in a project like that, and it costs like $1.2 million per kilometer of cable that you actually have to build to get to the nearest grid connection point. So that's quite expensive. It's not trivial.
I'm sure it'll all get sorted out in the long run, and we, the consumer, will probably foot the bill.
Yes, indeed. I mean, that to some extent is going to be passed through. But, you know, again, that's where policy and government action becomes important, because if you look at what's known as the levelized cost of electricity, which is over a much longer time window, like for a solar farm, say it's around 25 years, which is the expected service life of the solar farm, we're talking about like 3 or 4 or 5 cents a kilowatt hour, whereas at the moment we're paying like 25 to 30 cents a kilowatt hour for fossil fuel based energy. So if you look at the cost of per unit of electricity over that time scale, the fact that we have to pay a little bit more initially to get the infrastructure and the actual renewable facilities built is going to allow us to have ridiculously cheap electricity down the track. So it's up to the government to sort of perhaps subsidize it, although that's probably not the right word, because it means that they have to offset the upfront cost for the consumer, perhaps with some form of loan that can then be paid back in the savings down the track. There are certainly ways of doing that, but there's no political will to address it.
Barry, I know what you do, just like we did with the Opera House. You have a lottery.
Well, indeed.
That's what we did. And actually, with the Harbour Bridge, for years, the toll supposedly paid for that. I might add, it continued afterwards when the whole bridge was paid off. But who cares about that? But certainly, that's how we paid for the Opera House.
Yeah, that's exactly right. So, you know, there's no limit in creative solutions to this problem. The point is that we need the investment now. Look, I think there's a lot of investors. I mean, from my experience in recent months, you know, where I've basically been given a piece of land, 220 hectares in Victoria, and I've been told, see what we can do with this land. And, you know, you can sell it for $3 million, and then all of a sudden you realize that if it's sold as specifically for a solar farm, suddenly it's worth like $8 million instead of $3 million, and you go, hey, whoa, you know, that's worth looking into. Let's see if we can get some investors interested. And they're lining up. You cannot believe how much interest there is in these projects.
Well, I look forward to hearing a bit more about that one, Barry.
Yes, well, I mean, there's a fair amount of commercial confidentiality around that, but that's just giving you an example of how things can turn pretty quickly.
There's never a dull moment in American politics.
You know that. I know that. Everybody knows that.
Join Professor Ed Blakely and myself, Sean Britton, as we dissect all the goings on in Washington and from sea to shining sea in US of Ed.
So here's a man in critical crisis. This is a guy who wears the title president, but is not a president.
US of Ed is proudly made in the studios of 2SER. Subscribe on iTunes, Wooshka, or wherever you get your podcasts.
You are fake news.
But look, if I could just end off with a couple of whiz-bang statistics on electric vehicles, because I think most people would be very impressed by these statistics. And that is, with Elon Musk's launch of the Semi, the big electric truck, you can find that on YouTube, and it's worth watching because he announced this big truck. The key fact is that the operating costs of this truck, or the total cost of ownership over the service life of the truck, is actually 20% lower than owning and operating a diesel truck, which is, you know, the convention at the moment. So it's likely, assuming this truck does come into production, to have enormous ramifications within the trucking industry. You know, if somebody can operate a business at 20% less overheads, then it's a bit of a no-brainer which way to go with that one. But then what happened was Elon Musk walked off the stage after he launched the truck. Everybody thought the event was over, but the back of the truck then opened up and this little car drove out. And the little car is in fact the Tesla Roadster 2. Because Tesla's first electric car was called the Roadster, and it was a pretty modest little electric car that they started off with before the Model S. The Roadster 2 is one incredible piece of engineering. It's rumored to cost around $250,000, which is a lot of money, admittedly. You can put down a $50,000 deposit on it today, and the production is meant to begin in 2020. But this little car, the Tesla Roadster 2, can accelerate from 0 to 100 kilometers an hour in 1.9 seconds. And that is faster than anything else on this planet. You can pay $2.5 million for a Bugatti Veyron, which will absolutely be left in the rearview mirror of the Tesla Roadster if you take off from the lights. So it's a tenth of the cost of the Bugatti Veyron, and it accelerates in under 2 seconds to 100 kilometers an hour, which is absolutely astonishing, and only an electric vehicle could ever do that. So there you go. You know, there's some pretty amazing stuff going on in the electric vehicle space, and we're living in some very exciting times.
I'm wondering what Formula One racers are going to think about all this.
Well, that's a good point. There is already Formula E, which is electric vehicle racing, and these sorts of accelerations and, you know, top speeds of hundreds of kilometers an hour are totally normal within Formula E. They're incredibly high-performance vehicles, and that's coming to the road near you soon.
Well, left aghast here. Thank you so much, Barry.
Thank you.
That's Dr. Barry Minor, once again talking about some of the complexities of electricity in Australia. Stories and sound files are on the AQOB website, www.aqob.com.au. We'll be back again next week at the same time. I do hope you'll join us then. Bye-bye.
Let's enjoy new stuff, old stuff, a real variety.
My pleasure.
And yay!
To SER 107.3.